You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm John Walk here on behalf of Dominion Resources. This case is before the court on a certified question of law from the United States District Court of the District of Connecticut. The question before the court, quite simply, is does Virginia apply the collateral source rule in a breach of contract case where the plaintiff's loss has been reimbursed in part by insurance which they obtained? The facts are as stated in the district court certification order, which were repeated verbatim in Dominion's brief. So I'll just launch right in. The court has recognized the collateral source rule for over 140 years, dating back to the case of Baltimore and Ohio Railroad versus Whiteman's Administrator in 1877. The court has applied the collateral source rule on many occasions since then, but always in the context of some kind of tort action. However, significantly, this court has never declined to apply the collateral source rule in a contract case or ruled that it was inapplicable. In fact, it was not until Schickling v. Aspinall in 1988 that the court even flagged that there was a distinction to be had here. And what the court said in that case was that it had simply never considered the question. And that is what brings us here today. Dominion's argument can be stated very simply. And that is, if you go back to the original rationale of the collateral source rule in the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad case, it is grounded in the law of contractual expectation.
Isn't that important, though, Mr. Walk? Because the way that the debate's being framed to us, as you pointed out earlier, is a categorical thing. Does it apply to contract law? Does it not apply to contract law? The restatement version of this and the history of the case law generally is it depends. And one of the biggest things it depends upon is did the contractual understanding of the parties allocate a certain loss? In other words, if a contractual understanding of the parties said, look, let's all three get together and do something. You get insurance for property, you get insurance for fire, I'll get insurance for liability, and no one's going to get subrogated against anybody. You walk away from that thinking, right, and your fire, your whatever, and my liability. So are we overstating the issue? Isn't it a matter of looking at the contract and seeing where the contractual expectations were?
Well, Justice Kelsey, I understand your question completely. And the way I would answer it is this. You have to remember there's an underlying case going on in the district court in Connecticut. And the question that you've posed is the Aegis policy in this case truly collateral? And Alstom spent a bunch of time in their brief trying to argue that it really was part of the transaction. Well, if that's the case, then it's not collateral. But that's not the question that was asked to this court.
I know, but I'm fearful that we open a giant door. Contract collateral doors, don't worry about it. And every steed runs through that door when maybe this one horse is not going to make it 5 feet.
Well, what I would say on that one, Justice Kelsey, is y'all are free to frame your opinion however you want. And it's also important, I would note, that what we're talking about is a very particular collateral source here, and that is insurance, not some other kind of collateral payment, which has been the case in many, many cases, which is really brings me back to the point that I was making originally, and that is that these early cases all apply a very specific rationale, and that is where the plaintiff has gone out and on their own procured insurance, paid for it. The defendant is not a party to the insurance policy. The defendant gave no consideration for the insurance policy. They're not a named insured. Under those circumstances, there is no equity in the defendant claiming that their liability is mitigated by the fact that the plaintiff went out and got collateral insurance. And that's the point that I'm making.
Is there a caveat point? Unless the expectations of the parties, given either the nature of the agreement or the reasonable inferences from the transaction itself, would not have expected double recovery by the voluntary insurance by one of the parties.
Well, let me also supplement what I said earlier, Justice Kelsey, because I understand where you're going with this, and my answer is that that's an issue that might be very legitimate to be argued in the Connecticut case, that the Aegis policy is not, in fact, collateral to this transaction. But let me respond a bit further by pointing to the actual contract here, the alliance agreement, where Alstom argues a lot in their brief that this really was part of the transaction, as your question brought out. If you look at the actual contract provisions, and it's very important that Alstom never cites any particular provision of the contract. They always talk about, oh, the contract contemplated this, or the contract implied that. Well, what the contract states in paragraph 7 is it sets forth very specifically insurance that is to be obtained by the parties, and it sets forth requirements for Alstom to obtain policies that meet certain criteria. There is zero requirement of Dominion obtaining any insurance whatsoever.
Right, but the fact that subrogation is understood to be waived, doesn't that strongly imply the intention of the parties is, let's cover losses, we're going to agree that we're going to at least cover this much. Subrogation is waived. If you want to go out and get more for Dominion's losses, the expectation, I think, would be similar.
Here again, Justice Kelsey, the provision about waiver of subrogation, I want to note a couple of items about that. First of all, it's not an ironclad requirement. It says the parties are going to try. Secondly, it talks about we'll try to get our insurer, Aegis, to waive subrogation. Aegis is not seeking subrogation here. And lastly, it says that
I don't think that helps you. I think it hurts you that they're not seeking subrogation. Because the expectation that they could seek subrogation would clearly eliminate the double recovery angst of the other side.
Well, let me answer that question. Let me first finish answering your prior question, and that is also the very waiver of subrogation provision that you're referring to says the insurance companies will not seek subrogation from each other. Here, Aegis is not seeking subrogation. Nor are we suing Zurich or Alliance. We are suing Alstom. And that's simply a situation that is outside of this provision that you've talked about. Also, Justice Kelsey, on the question of subrogation,
question, make sure I didn't hear you incorrectly. As you read this contract, if there was an insurance recovery within the insured expectations, what was it, $5 million? If there was an insurance recovery, did this contract preclude subrogation against any party?
It said that our insurers would waive subrogation against each other. It doesn't talk about the parties. And I'm specifically citing, I'll give you the joint appendix page here, Justice Kelsey.
Why would you do that? You waive subrogation against co-insurers, but not waive subrogation against the tortfeasor, one of which might be a breacher of this very contract?
Well, and Justice Kelsey, what I would note in response to your question is that the way Alstom is trying to twist this one sentence is that we've effectively waived any right to sue Alstom for breaching the contract, which would rather gut the entire contract. It's a very specific provision that says our insurance company will not seek recovery from their insurance company. And that is not what is happening here.
Counsel, I'd like to move to a different topic.
Yes.
Some of the jurisdictions that allow collateral source in contract cases indicate that it has to be applied on a case-by-case basis.
Yes, sir.
You can't just simply have a blanket rule. In this particular case, does the party's expectations with regard to whether it was an eroding policy or not an eroding policy, is that relevant to whether the collateral source should be allowed?
Well, on that one, Justice Mims, I'll have to think about that for a second, but I'd like to answer your question by pointing to the case Jacobs Engineering versus ConAgra, which, interestingly, is not a case that we cited in our brief. It's the lead case that Alstom cited in their brief, and they cited it for the principle that the collateral source rule doesn't apply in contract. The case didn't say that, though. What the case did was it applied the very case-by-case analysis that you're talking about. And what is significant about the Jacobs v. ConAgra case is it involved virtually identical facts. A massive industrial catastrophe, a contract between the parties that called for insurance and indemnity and defense, etc. So virtually identical facts here. And what the court did in that case, Justice Mims, was it applied the very case-by-case analysis that you're asking about, only in an interesting way that's a little different from what you asked. It said, we're dealing with a contract here, but the subject of the contract incorporates within it tort concepts of negligence and indemnity. And based upon the idea that the underlying facts were tort-based, and that the contract itself, while it was a breach of contract action, there were no tort claims in that case, nonetheless, the subject matter of the contract embraced the concept of negligence and indemnity, and based upon that, that was the key factor upon which the court applied the collateral source rule. So I would not push back on the idea of a case-by-case analysis. I would just submit that the Jacobs v. ConAgra case is an excellent guide as to how that case-by-case analysis might be applied here.
Councilman, I follow up just a little bit based on part of that answer, but also an earlier answer you gave. It seemed to me that you almost implied that we should or consider rewriting the question. So my question is this. If we answer this question no, what would be the impact upon the case you have in Connecticut?
That the collateral source rule does not apply?
Yes.
That case is over. Because the parties have already stipulated that if the recovery from Aegis is applied in mitigation of Alstom's loss, we're done. So if the answer that comes out of this decision is no, the litigation in Connecticut, I believe, would be over.
Okay.
Let me address one final topic, because I would like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal. And that is Alstom's core argument here is that there's a fundamental distinction between the object of damages in tort versus the object of damages in contract. And they say that the whole point of damages in tort is to punish the wrongdoer versus the whole object of contract damages is to compensate the plaintiff. Interestingly, they cite no Virginia law for this argument because there is none. And in fact, as we've cited in our brief, this court has stated many times that the object of damages in tort is to compensate the plaintiff for the defendant's wrongdoing. We cited in our brief Camelot Corp v. Haley and Acuar versus Latorno. So the court has never said the whole idea of tort law is to punish the tortfeasor. Now, what Alstom has done is they have confused punitive damages and compensatory damages. And here's the point I'd like to leave you on and reserve my remaining time for rebuttal, and that is that punitive damages only apply in a small percentage of tort cases, those involving willful or malicious conduct, versus the collateral source rule applies across the board, including cases involving ordinary negligence. So there simply is no correlation between the collateral source rule and punishment, which is the whole point of Alstom's argument here. In fact, you can't even conjure a hypothetical where the collateral source rule would even apply to punitive damages because they're not driven by the plaintiff's loss.
Can I interrupt you 1 second? I won't take too much of your time.
All right.
If in fact there's a case-by-case model that should be adopted, are there factual hearings necessary in your case to flesh out these contractual interpretations? Are there ambiguities, parole evidence, representations to the parties, blah, 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 to explain the contractual understanding?
That would be the whole Connecticut litigation, Justice Kelsey. That case is still going on.
So in theory, if what I'm understanding correctly, we could in fact say, well, in theory, it can apply.
And here's where. Yes.
We're in limited circumstances, but this may or may not be the circumstance where it would.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you.
In a minute 15, Mr. Rock.
May it please the Court, James Walker on behalf of Alstom. I would like to have Mr. Michael Feese, who's been admitted for Lockbeachy, present the oral argument for the appellate.
Mr. Feese, where are you coming from?
Louisiana, Your Honor.
Well, welcome here. We're glad to have you.
Well, happy Mardi Gras, and thank you for having me. I did want to take a little time to start off by thanking the Court for allowing me to be here, to appear before a court with such great history and great distinction is truly a high point for me.
One that doesn't apply to civil law, thank goodness.
One that, exactly. So I truly view it as an honor and a privilege, and I appreciate it, and I thank you for that. What the plaintiff is asking you to do today is to change the law as it's been applied by this court for almost 150 years. And that law is the limited application of the collateral source rule only to tort actions. And we submit that the law should not be changed and that the collateral source rule should not be extended to breach of contract actions, and that there are good reasons for maintaining that distinction between contract and tort law.
Is it really fair to say that we would be changing the law?
Yes.
Because the last opinion we issued, we had a footnote, which both of you cite, where we very carefully said, we've never yet recognized it, but the implication should be pretty obvious. We have never rejected it either. It's just not been framed properly for us.
So I guess it's tone of voice. We would view that comment in the, I guess the plaintiff would view that comment as, we have never applied the collateral source rule. We would view that as, we have never applied the collateral source rule to a breach of contract claim.
It wouldn't have been in a footnote if that were the case.
It wouldn't have been in a footnote. But yes, we do view it as a change in the law, Your Honor, because there has also been cases where the court has talked about the presently recognized parameters of the collateral source rule and how the collateral source rule has never been applied to a breach of contract action. So, yes, we do believe it would be a change in the law if you would do that.
So what would happen if you had a roofing contract, a homeowner has a roofing contract, and the roofer screws something up and burns the whole house down? And for whatever reason, you have homeowner's insurance, but for whatever reason, you bought a policy that doesn't have subrogation rights or has been waived or whatever. Would that mean that the homeowner, having gone out, paid their own money to get that insurance policy, can't sue the roofer for burning the place down?
Your scenario speaks in terms of negligence-tinged claims. Lots of times when you
call it a roofing contract, and right, well, maybe I shouldn't say burn place. There's some breach of warranty of service or whatever, some breach of a contract. The roofer screwed up the contract, warranted he wouldn't burn the place down, and now it's a contractual claim as opposed to a tort claim.
So one of the things you will see in the cases, one of the things we're saying in this case is that you can make this ruling without reference to the facts. You can say that the law does not allow for the application of the collateral source rule in breach of contract actions. But in the cases from other states where they do apply it, they seem to emphasize whether or not the defendant contributed part of the consideration.
Okay, well, let's use my example and help me understand how your ruling would affect it. The roofer breaches the roofing contract, and the roof caves in and burns the house down. The homeowner's policy pays the homeowner, but there's no subrogation, and there's a possibility of subrogation.
It's a double recovery.
Right. So the homeowner can't sue the roofer for breach of contract because the homeowner spent, I don't know, $4,000 buying a premium. Would they at least get the premium money back?
Well, if the premium money is alleged as part of the cause of action, which has not been done in this case, I suppose that would be an available mechanism to get back the premium money. But where we're focusing, Your Honor, is
that on would be the tough under Hadley versus Baxendale, that you can expect in every contract that someone's going to go out and buy insurance for you not to breach your contract.
The policy of tort law is to discourage conduct that the society at large deems to be wrongful. The policy of contract law is to encourage commerce and economic activity by protecting the party's reasonable expectations in contracting.
So let's look at the reasonable expectations for a moment. I want to go back to the eroding policy question.
Yes, sir.
Dominion's argument is that they contracted for you to provide insurance that was not an eroding policy. You've denied that that was the party's expectations. Is the determination of the court that has the substantive issues in front of it relevant about whether there was a breach about in terms of the eroding policy? Is that relevant to whether the collateral source rule should apply?
No. That is an issue in the case as to whether or not the contract did, in fact, require eroding versus non-eroding coverage. You know, and I would comment with regard to all of these contractual interpretation arguments that there is references in the record that this contract is a plaintiff-drafted contract. So to the extent that we're talking about ambiguities, we've got the rule of interpretation that says you interpret it against the drafter.
But again, my question
yes,
is,
sir.
Is is the fact that they protected themselves from your alleged breach, is that relevant to whether the collateral source rule should apply? I'm not asking you, did you breach? I'm saying they have alleged a breach, and they've alleged that they purchased protection. In other words, they so much wanted to ensure their ensure their contractual expectations that they purchased insurance to make sure that their contractual expectations were met.
That's what the contract contemplated. The contract contemplated. The contract had reciprocal indemnities, insurance requirements. Each party indemnified the other for its own negligence. Insurance requirements. And the contract's insurance requirements said that Alstom would obtain certain kinds of insurance with limits of $5 million. Non-eroding limits, $5 million. Alstom got that coverage, got that $5 million in coverage. Dominion was free to insure for amounts in excess of that coverage. But as part of the consideration for that agreement, any insurance that Dominion obtained in excess of that $5 million would include waivers of subrogation, such that the insurance company could not come back against Alstom and recover those additional amounts. Does that answer your question? And that's exactly how it worked in this case. The accident happens. The $5 million of coverage that Alstom secured was paid over to the Dominion parties. The Aegis policy reimbursed the Dominion parties for the excess amounts, and the Aegis insurers have not asserted subrogation rights and, in fact, have testified in the case that, no, Dominion doesn't have to reimburse them. Us, they can if they want, but it's their money to keep. This would truly be a double recovery, a windfall in this case.
Well, that's your best argument. Let me also move on to basically some of the courts have indicated that this is really a policy question outside of the particulars of any case. It's a policy question. What about the argument that the policy should be to encourage the purchase of insurance? What's your response to that? This is a matter of public policy, a matter of economic policy.
I think there has to be a distinction drawn between whether it's a tort claim or whether it's a contract claim. You know, certainly spreading the risk is a policy that's encouraged in terms of obtaining insurance. But I don't see how the policy of encouraging people to encourage insurance would affect the determination of whether the collateral source rule should apply in a breach of contract action where the underlying policies are different from the tort context in which the collateral source rule is typically applied. We're trying to, in the collateral source rule, we're dealing with two competing policies of tort law. You know, in both tort law and in contract law, there's this notion of you shouldn't get double recovery. You know, you shouldn't be put in a position better than if you were if the contract hadn't been breached and the plaintiff shouldn't have a double recovery. So those two policies coalesce. But in tort law, there's this conflicting policy that we want to discourage wrongful, tortious conduct, and at the same time, we don't want to have a plaintiff have a double recovery. Well, with that conflict, in tort law, the balance is struck against the tortfeasor, against the wrongdoer, against the person whose actions society views to be wrongful in a context broader than just two people contracting with a result.
Well, and in addition, when you have sophisticated commercial parties, they can plan out. I mean, I don't see any problem if a party expressly says they'll recover these types of damages and just agree to that. But in the tort context, you don't have that ability. I mean, you just go out driving in your car and someone hits you. You don't have that ability to plan and anticipate in the same way than you would in a contractual
sense. And that's you're absolutely right. And that's the fundamental distinction that we have in this case, Your Honor, with the contract allocation of risks and responsibilities, the contract allocation of certain amounts of insurance to one person, the ability of the other person to obtain insurance in excess of those amounts, and the assurance of the other person who obtains that excess insurance that there won't be any subrogation rights, that you won't have to pay back the insurance company, the allocation of risk between two commercial parties.
I take it you wouldn't necessarily object if the parties would expressly say you can recover if this contract is breached, you can recover these types of damages.
That's for the parties to...
But the question is, what default principle in the law should we have?
And that's why we say that in this particular case, the default principle and the certified question that is before you can be answered in the negative without reference to the underlying facts. No. In a breach of contract action, in an action based solely on breach of contract, where there are not any underpinnings of tort or tortious conduct, that the collateral source rule does not apply as a matter of policy to maintain the policy of tort and to maintain the policy of contract.
But isn't that too simplistic? I mean, if we're dealing with a default principle, that presupposes there are circumstances where the presumptive answer is not always right. So why wouldn't the right answer be the statement 347 is exactly right? Generally speaking, we don't apply it. And in Virginia, we've never applied it. That's pretty powerful evidence of what the default principle is, isn't it? But there can be circumstances where the contractual expectations of the parties would suggest it could be applied, which actually benefits you greatly because then the burden of proof would not be on you. But we don't have this case to try this case. We haven't, you know, heard parole evidence, the expectation of parties. We hear that there's, you know, going to be some contractual canons being implored as to who negotiated what and signed what clause. And so why isn't it a more simple equation, the way you present it, too simple? Why isn't the answer the default is it doesn't apply? There are circumstances where it can, and here are some of the circumstances, and your court can determine whether the circumstances exist at an evidentiary hearing.
I don't think it's too simplistic, Your Honor, to make that rule, and I don't think it's too simplistic because of the absence of the conflicting policies in tort law which prompted the genesis of the collateral source rule
in
the first place.
And that certainly justifies the default principle.
Right. But if you want to go, if the court feels it's necessary to go to the underlying facts of this case, then we would say that especially in this case, that it is not a vehicle to broaden the application of the collateral source rule.
Let me ask you this, counsel.
Yes, sir.
Let me flip the question around that I asked Mr. Walk. Let's say we answer the question yes, the way it's phrased right now. What does that do to your case in Connecticut?
It eliminates Dominion's claims against Alstom. That's what it does to the case.
No, because yes would be yes, the collateral rule.
Oh, if you answer the question, yes, it does apply, there's still a lot to litigate. There's lots of issues swimming around in the case still. There's the issue of whether or not the contract did, in fact, require non-eroding coverage. There's the question of whether or not the claims are barred by the statute of limitations. There's the question of whether, and it's something that I wanted to touch on, but it seems like I'm not going to have enough time. There's the question of whether the Virginia anti-indemnity statute would apply to void these claims. And think about what we're thinking about here. The claim is being made for $9.9 million in defense fees that Dominion paid in defending itself against allegations that its negligence and gross negligence caused an accident which resulted in tragic loss of life.
So
and
this
damage.
Implicates a lot of contract principles, litigation perhaps, all kinds of things.
There's lots of things going on in this case if you would answer the question no. I see that I have run out of time, but just in conclusion, I would say that, you know, we do think you can make a bright line rule in this case, but if you do look at the underlying facts of this case where the plaintiff has been fully reimbursed by an insurer for the total amount of damages it seeks for the defendant, where the insurance was contemplated by and maintained in connection with the underlying contract agreement with the plaintiff and the defendant, and where the insurer has not made any claim for subrogation or reimbursement of the amounts paid against the defendant, and where the recovery of the claimed amounts from the defendant would truly result in a windfall that places the plaintiff in a better position than he would have been in had the contract not been breached as alleged, this is not the vehicle to broaden the application of the collateral source rule. 15 minutes. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Walk, you have a minute 15. You think you can end right on the red light?
Thanks so much, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to make a couple of super quick points. First of all, in response to the notion that we're arguing that we should change the law, Justice Kelsey already pretty much addressed this, but I want to just add one thing. And that is the reason why I walk through the development of the collateral source rule is we're not asking you to break new ground here. We're asking you to look back at the Baltimore and Ohio versus Whiteman's administrator case Johnson v. Kellum, Owen v. Dixon, these are cases that the court has cited many times and simply apply that rationale here.
Oh, those tort cases?
Those were all tort cases,
okay.
Yes.
What should be the default principle? We have a restatement section and we have literally a half a page of single space cites where the default principle is, generally speaking, the collateral source doctrine is inapplicable to contract disputes.
You're referring to the string cite in Alston's brief.
Well, let's not deal with that reason. You don't have enough time for that. 347 of the restatement second of contract. So the general default principle is that it is a tort concept. Why wouldn't the right answer in this case be right? And that's why we've never applied it in 200 years of being here. But there can be contractual expectations to suggest it should be applied.
Well,
and that requires evidence and argument and all these debates about the nature of the clauses. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that legal position?
I see my time has expired. May I answer the question?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Two answers to the question, Justice Kelsey. First is the pretty much obvious one that we noted in our brief, and that is this court doesn't slavishly follow the restatement. In fact, as you know, in the case of promissory estoppel, that's a very popular provision cited by many courts around the country. This court has said we don't follow the restatement. But I want to answer your question a little more deeply, and that is the restatement has gravitas because it is not supposed to be making law. It's supposed to be restating the law. But yet, going back to the string cite that you mentioned, those are a bunch of federal cases and intermediate appellate court cases versus if you take all the cases that we have cited and all of the cases that Alstom has cited, and simply strike out all the cases that are other than the case of a peer court, in other words, the highest appellate court of one of our fellow states, you'll find that those decisions break about 3-1 in our favor of saying, of course, there should not be a distinction here. If it is a situation where the collateral source rule would apply in court, it should also apply in contract. So this case-by-case notion that certainly exists in some cases, like the Jacobs v. ConAgra case that I mentioned earlier. That notion absolutely exists, but that is the minority position. The majority of Supreme Courts of our fellow states, 15 off of them, have ruled that there's no distinction to be had between tort and contract, and the same rationale applies to both. With that, I will ask the court to rule in our favor and sit down, unless there are further questions.
This session of the Supreme Court will be adjourned.